Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Latino Vote Podcast. I'm joined by none other than the now award-winning Mike Madrid. Mike, how are you doing this morning?
Good, Chuck. It's great to see you. It's so good to see you in person in Washington, D.C. last week. A lot going on. Always good to catch up, break some bread.
No. You don't get to just glaze past that. So for those of you who don't know, we were both in D.C. together last week for the Unidos U.S. Capital Awards, where Unidos U.S., the largest Latino nonprofit in North America, gave none other than my co-host and brother, Mike Madrid, the big public award, along with a U.S. senator, Ben Ray Lujan. So I don't know how Mike Madrid got to be on the same stage as Ben Ray Lujan, but the podcast, the team here is super proud of him. I was asked to come in and do a little ad-libbing and do his introduction. So I got to hang out with Mike and be with the Solidarity family. So, Mike, it was really good to see you and quite an honor that you got, man. And the video that the Unidos put together was really, really cool.
It was great. And it was, such an honor to be there with people that I have looked up to and admired for many, many decades. Janet Murguia, Raul Izaguirre was at, the table, just a legend in the Latino community for years, started what was then National Council of La Raza almost 50 years ago. And the organization back then was, just a small single digit of the population, the national population. Of course, now we're barreling down towards being the largest ethnic plurality in the country. And just watching the trajectory of an organization like this change, there were probably 600-700 people there in attendance at the National Museum.
What a beautiful venue, wasn't it?
Unbelievable venue, just gorgeous, top shelf. Senator Padilla, our good friend Alex Padilla, the senator from California, came in. We got a chance to get caught up. We were kids when we knew each other. We were laughing about that. I met him when he was 26-year-old president of Los Angeles City Council. And I was just kind of a young buck, and we've always had a great relationship. And then to kind of have that moment where you talk about how far you've been, how much you've done for our community, we've done for our communities in our respective ways. And your kind words, Chuck, we're just awesome. There's nobody I'd rather have kind of set an introduction. I know how many friends you have there. To set that up, I think for me was just kind of the capper of the whole evening. So thank you for that. And thank you to Unidos U.S. It's just the honor of my career to be recognized by a group who I've followed throughout my entire trajectory of my professional life. And to be honored like that was just something very, very special.
Well, it was cool. There was a lot of great people there, and it was quite the honor for us. It was a great honor for this podcast. Let's be clear, for all of you that are listening, like Mike Madrid has made his own way, just like Chuck Rocha has made my own way. But, this podcast has really lifted up exactly what me and Mike envision, which is not just my voice and his voice, but your voice and the importance of having Latino voters, the comunidad, for our community to be lifted up. And now Mike's getting recognized. Our community is being recognized in the press. It's going to be such a part of this midterm election, as this presidential election cycle as we barrel into. And we're going to get into it now. Now that we're not having the podcast every week, we're going to have a little bit of catch-up hour here in the beginning. And we're not going to talk for an hour, but kind of catch you up on what's happening and try to take the news of today and how does that influence our community and how does our community have an influence over the news? And one of the first things, we're at a time in history where we're past the State of the Union. We can get into the State of the Union and how he did and what he did. But does that have a great bearing on the Latino community? Not all of it. A lot of it is pomp and circumstance. At some point during this conversation, Mike's thought on how immigration was talked about. But the thing that Mike is more qualified than me to speak about that I want to start this off with is talking about Joe Biden, who's right now overseas. He just gave this big speech in Poland. Oh, my God, he showed up in Kyiv. He took a train for 10 hours. Mm-hmm. And I know Mike Madrid has been over there. Mike, what do you think that this visit means for our politics as a whole as we're starting to look at the presidential primary on the Republican side?
There's a lot of pieces to this. And let me just say, I have been on that train from Poland to Kyiv about a year ago.
Wow.
It is not an easy train ride. I mean, you're literally going through the bloodlands of Ukraine, where millions, 12 million Ukrainians were starved to death by Joseph Stalin. this country has a very long sordid past with Russia, and I can't say how significant it is for the leader of the free world to go by train. You can't go, you know, there's no flying over Ukraine, right? This is a war zone. And I can't imagine the logistics of security of taking the president of the United States through the back country of Ukraine to get to Kyiv, completely top secret, when every possible second could be, you know, a danger to the president of the United States. So kudos to them, the Biden administration, and the people who pulled that off. Which really leads me to the question, and that is how significant this is. Look, it was only a year ago where everybody was saying this is going to be a 72-hour war, that this would be done when Russia rolled on Kyiv and it would be over, it would be done, Zelensky would be toppled. The whole strategy of the Russians was what we call the decapitation movement, which is to just take out the head of state. Famously, Zelensky, of course, rebuffed the Western world and says, I don't need a ride, I need ammunition. If we'll remember that, he was going to stay and fight with his people. And the world was introduced to a new leader for this new century, in this new digital era, where this young, vivacious, energetic leader, it really starts to define what a framework for the new geopolitical world looks like. And Biden, to his credit, is standing strongly with Ukraine and leading the free world in financing the war, funding the war. And make no mistake, this is our war. You know, we keep pretending like this is like the Ukrainians versus the Russians. And of course it is on the map, but we all know that Russia's agenda is to go far beyond Ukraine. This is a threat against NATO. It's a threat against the free world. It's the first time physically there's been a confrontation between the rising authoritarian threat that we've seen with the Russians screwing around with our elections and screwing around with democracies around the world, whether it's, again, here in the States or in Brazil or in Hungary or in France or in Italy. All of these Western nations and throughout the world, like we saw in Latin America, are being funded by these sophisticated Russian efforts, all of which goes to say, Chuck, Biden, I think, any concerns that there were about his inability to handle affairs on the global stage, most notably the Afghan, the pullout of Afghanistan, the ending of the war, have all been ameliorated, have all been put away. Biden, to this point, has led an incredible global coalition to fight against authoritarianism, as strong as Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as strong as a Harry Truman, as strong as any military leader of a U.S. presidency of the last century. And the American public is standing with him on these issues. The American public still supports Ukraine, softening a little bit. It's going to get really, really challenging as China gets more aggressive. So obviously not a foreign policy show here, but it's a big question. And for the first time, really, since the 1988 election, I believe foreign policy is going to be a major issue, a top one or two issue, probably right behind the economy, as we head into a presidential election and decide whether or not Joe Biden's going to be reelected or not. What are your thoughts politically as things stand?
I think you make some great points. I think that I'm not a policy expert, especially in foreign policy, but I am a political expert, and I just kind of sat back and, as an ad maker, Mike, looked at the imagery of the shots, as me and you would say, right? And the ad writes itself of him walking through the streets of Kyiv with the president while there's air raid sirens going on. That's what stuck with me, right? Because as ad makers, me and you are looking at the visual of telling a story. Like I couldn't probably find the country they're in on a globe if you asked my ignorant ass how to do that. Like that's not my gig. But what I do look at is like the imagery of the power, and then how politically this puts the right in a bubble, not a bubble. It puts them in a bind, because what I see then is I see Nikki Haley announcing for president and coming out and talking very hawkish on China and Russia combined, while others on the right, whether it's Tucker Carlson or other MAGA like, who are saying, you know, Ron DeSantis from Florida was on Fox News immediately after Biden was on the ground saying, Joe Biden shouldn't be over there worrying about this. He should be worried about spending money at home, not overseas. So I think that dynamic within the Republican Party, I'd like your thoughts on how that's going to play in a presidential primary with a Republican primary electorate.
Well, first, let me say, as somebody who's been in Kyiv when those air raid sirens go off, you jump out of your skin. And to see how cool and collected the president was when any one of those sirens could have meant incoming artillery or a tactical nuclear strike or a tactical chemical weapon, he didn't even blink. So, yeah, I think you're right. The imagery there, what is likely to come, could not be stronger for the president, and deservedly so. He's got the metal, he's got the fortitude, and he's doing a hell of a job leading the country going forward. Look, the Republicans are going to have to draw some contrast, as we call it in the business, regardless of what the president does. When they are relegated to saying that he should be more focused on domestic issues at a time when he is staring down, literally staring down Vladimir Putin, and making Putin look like a fool. The president wasn't just in a war zone. The president wasn't just in Kyiv. He's like 150 kilometers from the Russian border. That is an embarrassment.
That's very important for people listening to know that.
It's an embarrassment for Vladimir Putin. It's a slap in the face. It's just incredibly defiant and makes Biden look incredibly strong on the global stage, not just to Russia, not just to the West, but to China, who's obviously watching these developments very closely. So look, these America Firsters, which is really, I think, just a pseudonym for coward and for isolationist and for protectionist and for nativist, they look weak. I think it's hard to say anything other than Joe Biden looked incredibly strong, incredibly commanding, incredibly powerful. And the Republican right-wing media complex is going to have to do something to draw some contrast with Joe Biden. And the way they're going to do it is by saying that he should be focused more in East Palestine, Ohio, as opposed to what he is doing in terms of leading a global coalition. Does it work? I think it does work to a certain extent. Is it going to be enough? No, it's not going to be enough. I think as we start to devolve into our partisan foxholes, as we get closer to the election cycle, I think it's very clear that people are going to start becoming as red as they are or as blue as they are, and the country, whether we like it or not, is heading into another very acrimonious and very close election cycle, and we're just going to have to see how this plays out. But I don't want anybody to underestimate how powerful the right-wing media cycle is. This stuff works. The messaging works. We're going to see a dip in support for Ukraine. We're going to see a rise in support from Russia. We're going to see Republican candidates contrasting with each other. I think you're going to see Donald Trump basically saying this war shouldn't be happening, that if he were president, he could work with Vladimir Putin to get us out of it. I think you're going to see DeSantis probably copycatting that message, and you're going to see Nikki Haley and some of the other also Rands towing the old Reagan-Bush line of having a strong national defense, being hawkish against Russia, and supporting Ukraine. And the great irony here is most Republicans to this day still are anti-Russia, still believe that we should be on the side of Ukraine. And to watch some of these leaders, which I believe, and I think there's plenty of evidence for it, have basically been co-opted by Russian intelligence, including Donald Trump, are going to be, we're just going to see how this plays out. We're going to see how much sway they have. I don't think it's going to be enough to be determinative in the Republican primary. I think Trump will probably be the nominee, but I think this issue is going to come back and haunt all of those that are supporting Vladimir Putin. I don't think it plays out well for them in the end.
So I do think that you're probably going to see that imagery that we saw this week in a TV ad at some point in this campaign for any ad makers that are out there. It's just something that you can't walk past. I think it stuck out to me and many of us artistic types in this work. Let's refocus back to America, as the MAGA Republicans would have us do. America first. We're going to talk American politics first. And big news. So for those of you listening, it normally takes a couple days for us the 5,700 editors we have that clean up this thing to make us sound good. So we're recording this on a Wednesday around lunchtime in D.C. on the 22nd. So I'm telling you that to say that what we're doing here is maybe a couple of days later than when you hear it. So this morning, which will be a day or two from when we actually get this thing posted, I wanted you to know that big news, some of the biggest news in the Senate, we talked about this in the last podcast, is that many of these senatorial campaigns are in red and purple states. And if these incumbents don't seek re-election, it really, really puts the majority that the Democrats have in the Senate at even more jeopardy. And that's two big states, and that is in West Virginia with Joe Manchin, and in Montana with Tester, and some say Arizona because she decided to run as an independent. We can sidebar on that one. But let's just say that this morning, John Tester gave Chuck Schumer a little kiss on the cheek because good old John Tester, that is John Deere tractor driving Tester, that is, I lost three fingers in a combine. And for all you city slickers like Mike Madrid, that's farming equipment that will cut your hand off. He literally lost three fingers in some farming equipment, has decided that he would, in fact, run for re-election in Montana, which he's the only Democrat that could win this Senate seat in Montana, and he can raise a shit ton of money. He can run a campaign. No matter who the Republicans put up, it's going to be a tough race for Mr. Tester, but at least the Democrats have a shot now, and have a good shot, because people in Montana like John Tester because he is a big old farm worker who's grew up on a farm, who don't like Chuck Roach. He ain't hiding where he's from. He lost three fingers in a combine, for God's sakes. And what we will talk about between now and November with Montana, and we talked about this a few weeks ago in our last podcast, is the largest growing percentage of new voters in Montana, mainly because of the tourism, is Latino voters. They're growing exponentially, and they're going to be a bigger factor than we've ever seen them be in a place like Montana that I think we will talk about, Mike, on this podcast moving forward, like we will in Ohio and in other states. What's your thoughts on Mr. Tester, Mike?
I think we need to look. We really ought to do an episode just on Montana, because
we should go to Jackson Hole and do it.
That's good. Go do that. I would love to do that. And look, and we'll talk to some Latinos on the ground too, and get their sense, not only of who they're thinking of voting for, but kind of what are the issues that are driving them. I think that'd be a lot of fun. And like you said, this will be a state where the margin between Tester and the Republican nominee will be the size of the Latino vote. It's going to be critical. And for the first time in Montana state history, you're going to see a strong, concerted Latino outreach effort and a Latino outreach campaign. So it's kind of cool. It's exciting. When it's happening in Montana, folks, it's happening pretty much everywhere. Now, let's talk about Tester real quick. I think your setup was exactly right. Tester and Manchin are the two Democrats that can hold their states respectively. These are both very Republican states culturally. They're largely monolithically white, with the exception of some of these small marginal changes that we're just talking about, especially Montana, where it's discernible. But they're also well-known commodities. These are people that are of these states, and they're very different. Their styles are very different. Joe Manchin, of course, has taken a much more transactional, pivotal stance and being kind of the determining, deciding vote. Tester could have done that. Tester could have been that person, but he's not. What I really admire about Tester, even though I disagree with a lot of his politics, you know, as a good Republican, I look at him and I'm saying, this guy's leading Montana in a different direction. This guy's actually, through sheer force of will and personality and his own personal relationships with Montanans, is actually changing the nature of the political culture in that state. He's voting more to the left, quote unquote, to the left of where his electorate is at, where his state is at. But he doesn't do it in the dark of night. He does it very publicly and explains to Montanans why he's doing what he's doing. And not only are they responding, but they respect it. And with that respect comes the ability to start influencing and moving votes. So look, this is an absolute must pickup for the Republicans if they're going to get to a majority. And I still believe that the Republicans will have a majority in the Senate when the dust is settled after this presidential race. It's just too tough a map for the Democrats. But this is a big piece. This plugs a very big hole for the Democrats. Tester is probably the only man on planet Earth that could win that seat for the Senate, for the Democrats in Montana. I think he probably will do it. I think even if the numbers don't look great, and they don't in Montana for a Democrat, even if numbers starts to sour for Joe Biden, and I'm not predicting that they will, I'm saying even if they did, Tester has the mettle to stand in there and withstand a lot of these trends, a lot of the political winds. People know him, and it couldn't be a better moment for Chuck Schumer, as you just said in the intro here to this segment. I think it's odds on that the Democrats hold Montana at this point.
And I need to correct myself. I said we'd go to Jackson Hole. Jackson Hole is in Wyoming. It's in Wyoming, not in Montana.
We can still go there.
It's really close. I was there last summer, as you know, with the Rocha boys for the Yellowstone, which is also in Wyoming. But we flew into Billings, Montana. So you can be, and then we stayed in West Yellowstone, which is in Idaho. So like Idaho, Wyoming, and Montana are like the tri-states up there. And I get really confused a lot as a country boy from East Texas. I've already told y'all I have trouble with sometimes maps. So that part of the country confuses me. But what don't confuse me is that this morning, they are breathing a little bit easier over at the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, because one of their biggest worries was that he would not run for re-election. So what Mike has talked about is the Tester race. Also remember, while Mike's math says that it's harder to keep the Senate, is because just Montana's one. The other is West Virginia. The other is Arizona. And then you throw in other states, the four that are just as hard, which are Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Now, in a presidential year, which we're going into, it is easier to win those states because turnout normally is higher for Democrats, a la normally higher in places where urban turnout, black turnout in Philadelphia, Detroit, Columbus, and Cleveland is higher. But if you start tweaking that just a little bit, if Biden's numbers go down for any reason, if Putin does something stupid and we go to war, all of these things could affect this any little bit, because to Mike Madrid's point, the margins are so small in the U.S. Senate. In the House, let's transition now over to the House. There's a lot of news happening in the House. As you know, Mike Madrid has smartly said that the Democrats will probably lose the Senate by one or two seats, who knows, but has a really good chance of picking up and winning back the Congress in the House, because as we talk about on this podcast, there are 18 congressional seats that Republicans currently hold that Joe Biden won in the last presidential election. And of those, me and Mike Madrid are going to be talking about the 10 of the 18 that have more than 30% Latino voter population. Well, in just three of the biggest ones this week, I've talked to Latinos that are looking to run in places where there's lots of Latinos in a seat that is currently controlled by Republicans. I've talked to Latinos who are planning on announcing soon in California 27, which I want to get Mike's take on. That's where he grew up, just in northern LA County. There's another race in California 13 that Mike Madrid called before I did, where Gray lost by just a few hundred votes, that have a substantial Latino population in the Central Valley. And then in a race that y'all got sick of us talking about, which is Texas 15, where we elected a new Latina Republican, Monica De La Cruz, or De La Garza, is the Republican woman there in an R+2 seat. I've already talked to a Latino businessman who's thinking about coming back and running in that seat. So just in those three seats, like we have predicted on this race, in this podcast, the only way to win back these seats, especially with these large Latino population, is to run probably a good Latino moderate candidate who can get from both sides and raise enough money. And Mike, is that what you're thinking in as well about these three seats that I'm already seeing movement in?
That's 100% right. And I'm going to underscore this a little bit more from a data perspective and kind of explain these districts. But the takeaway here is these three top targeted seats, if the Democrats don't put up Latino candidates, they're making not only a mistake for the 2024 election cycle, they are making a mistake for the medium and long term as well, because that's the only way they're going to hold these seats. That is the only way, because these districts are going to get more Latino. Which means if you don't have a Latino candidate and use that marginal benefit to your advantage, you run the risk of losing these marginally in a bad year for Democrats. And look, whether you like it or not, there's going to be tough years for Democrats, and some of those tough years for Republicans. That's just the nature of politics. Let's start with California 27. This is Congressman Mike Garcia, Republican, former military man, great military background. Held this seat. Actually, he should have lost this election cycle.
Michael. So for those of you at home, this seat that Mike's talking about, Joe Biden carried by almost double digits.
Yeah. And so you've got a Republican who wins his seat by almost double digits. It's in the northern part of Los Angeles County. It lips into Ventura County, which is where I'm from. This is literally the area where I was doing my first congressional races 30 years ago. This is the district where my mother, my sister live. I know this district very, very well. This is where I cut my teeth. And what I will say about this that is unique is this is not an urban district where you see a lot of Latino candidates, and this is not a rural district where you see a lot of Latino candidates. This is suburbia. Okay, this is one of the very few purely suburban seats where there is a discernible Latino electorate. Okay, it's the Santa Clarita Valley. We're talking Palmdale, Lancaster, parts of Ventura County, North LA County, not as much as Ventura County after redistricting got chopped up a little bit. This is where you have an upwardly mobile, aspirational, middle class folks who are college educated, military credentialed, people who are like a lot unlike Mike Garcia. And the Democrats put up a candidate named Christy Smith, who lost to Garcia, I think, three times now. This is the old Katie Hill seat, where she won this seat in the Democratic wave year of 2018. And then, you know, after a scandal, lost the seat. And Mike Garcia wins it in a special election, the Republican in a low turnout election, but holds it for the next two election cycles. The old rule of thumb here in politics is if you keep your seat for two election cycles in Congress, the chances of you holding it onto it for long term are pretty, pretty darn good. You got to beat somebody either in their first or second year. Once it goes beyond first or second year, just constituent services and all sorts of other reasons, name ID starts to kick in, and it gets really harder to unseat that incumbent. If Democrats don't beat Mike Garcia this year with a high turnout election cycle in a relatively new district, hard to see them picking up this seat for the next 10 years. If the Democrats don't put up a Latino candidate, shame on them. That's just political malpractice. It makes absolutely no sense to not have a good Democrat that meets Mike Garcia's basic profile, meets him eye to eye on all of those strengths that he has, and then has the value add of running in a district that Biden won by double digits. I mean, this is not brain surgery. You just match them like that and let the dice roll where they may, run a good campaign, and the odds are not just good, they're quite good that you're going to win that seat as a Democrat. This should be a pickup for the Democrats. I'm going to call this a Democratic pickup, assuming that the Democrats run a Latino candidate. If they don't, I don't see that they pick this up. I think they continue on a three strikes and you're out, you know, strategy here by continuing to put up sort of a white suburbanite who doesn't have the crossover appeal that is required in one of the few Latino suburban communities in the country. Chuck, how are you looking at this?
I think you're right about California 27. I want to talk about California 13 and then before we leave California, I'm really sitting here thinking about something that I think you know the most about. So in California 13, it's the same scenario. It's a seat that should be Democratic. Biden carried it by five or six, maybe as much as eight. The white Democrat is talking about coming back and running again, the dude who lost last time. There is a Latino that's filed to run, who ran and who the white Democrat beat in a two-way race for the top two jungle primary. So he's coming back. His name is Phil. He's run before. And so thinking about what if Phil and Gray run against each other, does he put together a better campaign to beat him? I think he does. I think people are yearning for a Latino in that seat as well. Here's what I don't know, and what I'd be curious, Mike, to get your thought about is this week as well, and I would be remiss if I should have brought this up in the Senate part, but I think it overlaps with this well. Also this week, boys and girls, for those of you at home, Barbara Lee, the congresswoman from San Francisco, or actually she's from Oakland and Berkeley, announced that she, an icon, right, in the civil rights movement, is going to run for the very crowded Senate seat that Feinstein is giving up, even though she probably don't know she's giving it up, with all due respect. But anyway, I digress. But that Barbara Lee's going to run she's going to right now run against Adam Schiff and then also Katie Porter. There's talk of other people getting in right now. The glaring hole is that there's no Latino candidate, Mike, mm-hmm. and that the Latino vote will probably determine of those people who actually wins that seat. If a Republican Latino gets in, there's so many what ifs. But here's my question. It's my Mike Madrid wind up is what does this primary do to these congressional seats where it's the top two finisher for those as well? Like, how does this affect that? Is it the turnout of millions of dollars being pumped into a primary? Is that it?
That's such a great question. And I guarantee you, we're going to revisit this as we get closer, because you just hit it on the head here. In California, you know, this is the first time since 1992 where the Dianne Feinstein won't be on the ballot running for the United States Senate. And it's going to open up, I think, the floodgates of not just a lot of candidates, but candidates that fill like every lane of the Democratic coalition. So the first two you have right now are, as you pointed out, Adam Schiff and Katie Porter from Orange County. Both of these are, I think, could very honestly, accurately be described as white progressive candidates. What most people outside of California don't know is that these seats usually go to the Northern Californian. Okay, and the reason why is the same way Barbara Boxer won this seat in 92, Feinstein wins this seat in 1992. They're basically neighbors, you know, live within 15 square miles of each other, both in Marin and San Francisco counties. That's the wealthiest, whitest, most educated, home-owning part of the state. All of those are indicators of high voter turnout. The southern part of the state, you have much lower turnout. Why? Because you've got a lot more Latinos, a lot more African Americans, a lot more people of color, a lot more poor people who tend to be renters. So even though there's a higher population, the advantage is for those wealthier white homeowning people in the north. And again, you're going to hear a lot about this in the next year, because a lot of East Coast reporters who don't know anything about California are going to start figuring this out. But you heard it here first on the Latino Vote podcast. This is going to create a dilemma for the Democrats, because of all states in the union that should have a person of color in the United States Senate to go to the halls of power with Alex Padilla, our friend Alex, it should be a person of color, should be from California. If they elect another white progressive, I mean, what a disappointment. But politics being what it is, people are going to do what they're going to do. Schiff and Porter throw their hat in the ring. Barbara Lee has some distinct advantages. Again, woman of color, I think that plays actually, hopefully, pretty well in the Democratic primary. She's a Northern Californian, comes from that media market with a strong bit of name recognition, and she's a woman. 56% of women in the Democratic primary are Democrats vote in that primary, so it's an advantage to be a woman. Now she's going to split that up with Katie Porter a little bit. But I don't count Barbara Lee out. A lot of people are saying, "Oh no, she doesn't have the moxie. She's too old. She's not much younger, different age than Dianne Feinstein." The truth of the matter is, she has occupies a completely different lane geographically, racially, ethnically. I think the gender lane helps her out, and ideologically, you know, she was the only vote against the Iraq War, which still is kind of a badge of honor with progressives. Now, the reason why, again, this is another long Mike Madrid windup here, is you've got these three candidates. Now that we're at three, the rationale for a 4, 5, and 6 candidates getting into this race make all the more sense. This race is dying, screaming, begging for a Latino to get into the race. Okay, and we can talk about some of those, and we'll probably speculate as to what they are. But once you get to 4, it makes more sense to get to 5. And then 5 argues for 6. And so this field, I think, is going to get big. I think it's going to get big quick. I think you could see, Ro Khanna has basically said, "I'm not going to do this, but if Ro gets in and Bernie backs him," I think that becomes a big deal. Elizabeth Warren's got her candidate with Katie Porter. Nancy Pelosi's got her candidate with Adam Schiff. You're going to have a number of members of the Congressional Black Caucus supporting Barbara Lee. You're going to have Latinos, you know, the Hispanic Caucus backing a Latino candidate. This is going to be like Mardi Gras. And again, today's Ash Wednesday, so go get your ashes, one, and figure out what you're going to give up for Lent right away. But Mardi Gras is the term that we're going to be using for this primary, because it's going to be a panoply. How do you like that word, Chuck Rocha? It's going to be a panoply of diverse candidates that each represent a significant lane in the Democratic coalition running in this U.S. Senate primary. And I think it's going to be a phenomenal tactical race because there's not going to be that much difference between them ideologically. It's going to be a masterclass in which campaign can identify their voters, spend the resources on getting them out, and it will absolutely have an impact on congressional seats like 27, Mike Garcia, which we just talked about in Northern Los Angeles County, and California 13, currently held by Republican Duval, where there's going to be a Latino candidate, Democratic candidate in the primary, taking on a white moderate Democrat by the name of Adam Gray. I've known Adam for a dozen years or so. He used to be a member of the California State Legislature, running to try to dethrone Duval. All of this is going to have a significant impact because of the top of the ticket and the nature of which voters are being targeted for turnout in this U.S. Senate primary.
Before we leave California, I'd be remiss to say that the other California race, California 22, which is Valadao, which is just south of Fresno there and part of Fresno, just to say that it sounds like Rudy Salas is coming back to run again. I don't know that. He's not filed, but that's what I'm hearing in Democratic circles. So there could be a Latino that we'll have all summer to talk about in all three of these races, Mike, to what we've been saying on this podcast, which is a big deal.
Yeah, real quick, one quick sentence before you wrap up. I would say that if Democrats had put up Latinos in California 27 and California 13, they would have won those two seats. And Kevin McCarthy's victory would be 3 instead of 5, his margin. If the Democrats had had the foresight to put Latino candidates in 13 and 27, they would have won both of those seats. I would bet the house on it.
California's going to change a lot in the coming years. I heard a thing this morning, Mike, that made me think about you. A reporter on a podcast or something I was listening to was talking about how California is going to be changing in the next 1 to 5 years. I did not realize you have 3 Democratic congresspeople in their 80s in California. I think it's Maxine Waters, Grace Napolitano, and there's one more. Garamendi or somebody maybe.
Oh, John Garamendi. Yeah.
He's probably 80 or 81. And then they have like 3 that are in their 70s. Barbara Lee is one. Mm-hmm. Matsui is the other one. And I don't remember the third. So you have 6 members in their 70s and 80s that we don't wish any of them to leave. We don't wish any of them to die or nothing bad. I'm just saying that they're 70 and 80 year old congresspeople. That means that in the next 5 years, they could all be gone, retired probably. And that's a big change in the way California looks. And it also makes me think to what Mike is saying, that somebody like a young doctor, like Dr. Raul Ruiz, that nobody talks about, right? Jimmy Gomez is young. You have this next crop of young Latino congresspeople, especially like Ruiz, who've been in a while, that if, not saying that I have any inside information here at all, I'm just saying that if I'm looking at who's talented, you know, even a Tony Cardenas, like there's a plethora that take that word for you. Again, I'm going to always go back to plethora, a plethora of Latinos or Latinas. Let me just make sure that I'm not just talking about a bunch of dudes, because there's Nanette Barragan. There's Linda Sanchez. Like, you want to talk about in the congressional delegation, there's a bunch of talent there. And if any of those decided to run, it would not up in the race, but me and you both know, Mike, that if there's a Latino surname on a Democratic primary ballot, it goes a long way. It's not the end all be all. Linda Sanchez proved that. And the other fella in LA who got in trouble, what's his name? The state senator back in the day, who was a city councilman who got in trouble. We talked about him.
Kevin DeLeon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, Robert Garcia was a mayor.
Oh my God. Great point. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, he's got big name ID in the Los Angeles media market. I mean, he's got to be on a short list. Now, he just got to Congress. I think he likes it there. He likes it in the House, but these seats don't open up very often. But there are a number of candidates that need to be looked at, need to be examined. And as you said, I just think it would be just such a huge missed opportunity for Democrats in California. Whoever gets elected is going to be there for 24 years. It's going to be there for a very long time. So it's not just an election cycle for the current diverse California as it sits. White people are the second largest ethnicity behind Latinos in California. Let's not forget that. But in 24 years, they'll probably be behind API, Asian Pacific Islanders too. It's like if the Democratic Party is really the party of diversity, this is their moment to prove it. And I think that there are enough candidates with enough caliber and substance to actually not just run credible campaigns, but to win and start defining a new narrative for the party. Not unlike what Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer did in 1992 in the Year of the Woman. It was a big deal in 1992. I know, Chuck, you were kind of old then too. So I don't know if you remember it, but I was a little bit younger and I remember it well. The, 1992, you know, was coming off of the Clarence Thomas hearings. And his confirmation hearings, and women were pissed, rightfully, and were running for office in big numbers. It was the first time California sent two women to the United States Senate from the same state. Might have been the first time in history that a state sent two women. But what I will say is this: it really, the time called for that. The time right now in California calls for a Latino candidate, at least one, in Alex Padilla, who just won his election effort here. But the, if I'm going to be just deeply disappointed in the Democratic Party, and I'm not a Democrat, but I'm just hearing all the rhetoric and watching it. If they can't elect somebody besides another white progressive, then shame on them.
I couldn't agree more. And if these black and brown candidates hire another white consultant to make their launch ad, my head may explode. You see me on Twitter this week. I'm sick and tired. We want to be the party of diversity, but we keep hiring when it comes to Senate races and other places. Congressional, it's just more white consultants when we talk about. Even when the damn ads say that they are champions of civil rights and diversity and lifting up women and black folks and brown folks, and then you have the same white consulting firms, like, that's just some bullshit. Anyway, I digress. We'll have all year to talk about this, but if you don't hire a bunch of brown or black consultants, I'm going to call you out on Twitter. Just get ready. Lastly, I want to talk about Texas 15. I think that there's going to be a multitude of Latino candidates, Latina candidates run there. We're going to keep an eye on that. But before we get to the wrap-up section, there was also more news made this week in the great state of Rhode Island. Rhode Island, Congressman David Cicilline, an epic leader of the LGBTQ movement, former mayor of Providence, Rhode Island, a good friend of the show's, David has decided that he is going to step down later this year, which is going to make a special election happen, which this podcast is going to cover very closely. And you would say, why does the Latino Vote podcast want to cover a special election in Rhode Island? Well, A, it's a special election that's going to happen probably in 2023 in an off year. But for you little boys and you little girls at home, you should know that there is, again, Mike Madrid, a plethora of Latino voters in Rhode Island. So much so that until this last mayor of Providence, the two prior mayors of the largest city in Rhode Island was a Latino. And back when I had more hair and was skinnier, I helped elect one of those mayors, Jorge Elorza. The Guatemalan Flash, I call him, a great leader, somebody who is back working at his university back in Providence now because he's term limited out. He served for 8 years. But there is a ton of Latino voters in this congressional district and in Rhode Island. There is a ton of Portuguese Latinos there, Hispanics, because back in the day they were fishermen who came there, Mike, a little history lesson, and settled in Providence. And then
whalers.
Yeah. Whalers. Yep. And now a bunch of Dominican and Puerto Ricans and Guatemalans take up big, big chunks of the city where it's almost majority people of color in the state. I mean, in the city of Providence, Great Falls has elected a Latino mayor. Like, this is one of these places me and Mike talk about that folks don't realize the influence of the Latino vote. In Connecticut, there's Puerto Rican mayors and stuff, lots of Puerto Ricans. But anyway, he announced yesterday that he was stepping down. And if I didn't get one text, I got six texts, to ask me if Jorge was going to run. Jorge's not going to run. But there are like three other Latinos and Latinas that I talked to who are now thinking about running in this special election. So it's going to be awesome to cover and see if we can elect the first Latina or Latino to a congressional race in Rhode Island. How does that hit you, Mike Madrid?
If you don't love this podcast, then there's something wrong with you. You don't get this kind of content anywhere else. Chuck Roach, first of all, I just learned something. Chuck Roach has elected more Guatemalans to office than I have. So congratulations, Chuck. Yeah, he's up top. Me, can put that one up on the board. The second is, when who else can talk about the Latino political dynamics of Providence, Rhode Island? Like, that is good stuff, people. That is good stuff. And it goes to the point with both of the breadth of where we have done work. I've never done work in Rhode Island, by the way. Maybe we ought to do a remote podcast from Providence.
It's a great city. Good food.
After we're done with Billings, we can go to Providence, Rhode Island, and cover Latino politics there. But I think just time, I guess, Chuck, is just the peculiar places that we've done Latino politics and all these places of the country. And now it's becoming dominant. Like you're saying, in Rhode Island, in Providence, the urban core there is it's people of color who are dominating. And you don't think of Latino politics being central to Rhode Island politics, but it is because of the history. So look, I hope you're engaged in some of those candidates and some of those contests, because I want some reports back, and maybe some food too. But I want to get some feedback from what's going on in Providence, Rhode Island, and the Latino political structure in Providence. It's just kind of funny to say, but that's why we launched this podcast. We want to talk to people about what's going on everywhere.
You're talking to the last guy in America who beat Buddy Cianci in a mayor's race in Providence. Now, you probably remember Buddy Cianci. He went away to federal prison and was a three-term mayor of Providence, went to prison and came back, and the good people of Providence reelected him after he got out of prison because he had taken such good care of the Italians and the Irish, especially the police and the firefighters union. And so when we ran Jorge's race, Buddy ran as an independent and ran against us in the general election, and I beat Buddy Cianci, which is a big feather in my hat, to elect a 36-year-old Guatemalan who had never run for public office. We'll have a whole separate podcast about some things we pulled off there. But anyway, look, guys, and look, girls, and all of everybody out there, all of you folks, that the Latino Vote podcast is proud to be on the air. We're proud to be covering 2023. Before I go to Mike to wrap us up, I would remind you, sign up on our website at latinos.vote. We have an aggregation of all the Latino Vote news of the day. We have a bunch of op-ed writers that are coming in now. We just invited a whole new crew of influential Latinos and Latinas to start posting more of their comments and more of their content. So go to latinos.vote, sign up for our listserv, because we're emailing out this stuff every week to people. You'll be the first to get it in your inbox, but go to latinos.vote to make sure you're getting up on the news. And Mike, why don't you take us home today?
Guys, let me just say there's a lot of really big things coming up on this podcast as we head into a presidential election. As you guys know, we started this effort heading into the midterms, and it's grown bigger and faster than we ever imagined. Thank you all for the phenomenal feedback, the ideas, the edits, the corrections, the concepts, the topics, and the guests that you have pointed in our direction. We are going to be really dramatically growing out the website and the webpage with some really cool data-driven content. But if you have ideas for that, let us know too. You're going to be hearing a lot about this in the coming weeks. We've got some great people involved with a great new project that I'm really excited to hear about and see and share with you all. But if you could do us a favor, if you could like and make sure you're subscribing and providing feedback on the content of the podcast, the more you're able to help elevate our voices, the more we're able to help elevate yours. If you could share this on social media and just pass the word along. And also, if you've got good guests that are ideas of what we should be talking about, let us know. While we have cut back a little bit during the off season, for the next couple of months, we'll be cutting back our programming schedule. But we're doing that so that we can position for a really aggressive finale into the last 14, 18 months of this election cycle, because this year, this 2024 presidential cycle, is going to be unlike anything we have ever seen before as it relates to the Latino vote. And I'm saying this with a big smile on my face because I have a very strong suspicion that I will be saying those same words every presidential election cycle for the rest of my life and my career, because the numbers keep getting bigger. They keep growing. It gets more dynamic. It gets more complex. It gets more interesting. And by the time we head into some of these, the later years of Chuck's and my career and cycles, we're hoping to hand this off to some other guests, not quite ready yet, but we'll hand this off to other people to continue this conversation. We want to thank every one of you for being a part of it, for being part of this family, part of the community. Send us those topics, hit that like button. and make sure you follow the website, not just for the news, the content, the op-eds, but because of the build out that we're going to be announcing in just a few short weeks. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Latino Vote Podcast.